Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark.
Hi, I'm Paul.
And I'm Ben.
And in this episode, coming to you from a quieter, although I can hear the police and ambulance outside, a quieter studio-like meeting room 4 of our new creative and media agency. Yes, we've moved to New Oxford Street. We've got our own reflections on Accenture's continued global takeover of creative industries. And Paul, Lush, is it brave of them to abandon social media?
Brave or a big mistake? Let's take a look.
And is it brave of ASOS to stop us sending stuff back, Ben?
We will definitely see.
And we review new campaigns about malaria, 150 years of Heinz, and a few comebacks. Let's do that.
Let's go.
So I guess none of us was surprised to read that Accenture has made another purchase. In fact, I read that it had been rumoured for a long, long time that they were about to jump on Droga5. And then within a few days, they bought Shackleton as well, which is, I think, an agency in Madrid as well. So it's just, I guess, they happen when they happen because these due diligence processes take ages. But guys, I don't know, what do you think about it? What does it mean?
It'll be interesting to see how Droga5 are able to sort of like play a sort of a more of a role upstream in what Accenture do. I think that's a really interesting opportunity. I think that's what the real great opportunity for creative agencies is to have, to get sort of stuck into other parts of a brand's business which they don't normally get access to as an advertising agency. And I think that's where the different types of creativity can come through, as opposed to just about creating ads. Commercial creativity doesn't need to just be about TV ads. It can be about other things, everything from supply chain down to sort of like, you know, how things work within the sort of day-to-day running of a business. So there's loads of different things that they could be positive about. I mean, the other side of it is that obviously Dave Droga is a sort of, you know, seen as the, sort of one of the the highest profile and the most interesting creative leaders in the world. And people feel that he's selling out. I don't know if that's true. I don't think that's the sort of a case of it. I think that's a probably, if you're going to sell, you might as well sell to someone that's going to give you more scale and more reach in the right way.
I think a lot of people would say, if you're going to sell, why don't you sell to somebody who's going to give you more money?
Well, yeah, there's obviously that as well.
I think actually that is where it's coming
I think
from.
As a this sort of deal, as opposed to private equity, is that they have been buying agencies for, I mean, the likes of Karmarama hit the press, but there's lots of other purchases. The one you mentioned in Madrid, there's other agencies that have been joining the Accenture Interactive family over the last couple of years. So I agree with Ben's point. I think the positive for someone like Droga5 is the opportunities, as Ben was touching on, not just access to other brands, but these other interesting challenges. And that's obviously for Accenture Interactive, that's why it's happening. They want to get into the CMO, they want to get into the other areas of the board table, I suppose, is much of it. And no disrespect to Karmarama, I think this purchase has been seen as a much bigger and bolder step into the creative industry. Like Karmarama is described definitely as more of a medium-sized business, and they're seeing, certainly with Droga as the leader, this is a much bigger, more deliberate purchase to take a bolder step into the creative world.
Everybody jumps on the fact that it's going to be a culture clash, as in the consultant and the advertiser. But when the senior Accenture people came into the room officially for the first day at Karmarama, the language they used was that we will create a culture of cultures.
They are creating confusion. I think they are. I think one of the articles I read was even on their website, you've got kind of something around advertising isn't the answer, but then right next to it is the news article about them buying Droga5.
Don't build brands for advertising anymore, is what they says.
That's the one. And there's things around, they're being a digital transformation business, trying to help CMOs save money in their digital advertising space. They're going through sort of the digi transformation, maybe more tech, which again, they're in that space anyways. And then to kind of come out with this big creative movement, I think it's creating a lot of confusion. What I'd like to hear from you, Mark, is kind of, we've all been in businesses where suddenly there's an acquisition or new departments that you're sort of compelled to go and sell and talk about and go to your existing clients and be like, hey, look at this new shiny thing, which more often than not they don't want. Like, just keep doing a good job.
You mean the clients don't want
it? The clients, exactly. Keep doing a good job of what you already do for me, and if I do need that, great, good to know. I'd love to know more about kind of how the senior management are tasked to suddenly be like, hey, look, we've got this.
In actual fact, no, there wasn't any edict to go and sell Accenture services. And I'll be honest, I was there for a year into the Accenture acquisition. The one expectation was that it would dramatically improve our analytical skills. But the challenge there is that they don't have loads of analysts sitting around waiting for stuff to do. Mm. It is a highly profitable, by the hour, consulting business. Mm. And so anybody who's any good is very gainfully employed on a project that they're being charged vast fees for. Mm. And so, you know, somebody like me, a planner, thinks, great, I've got a new intellectual toy shop to play with here. Well, no, I couldn't get access to them, really.
I mean, they do have a thing called the bench. I know a friend of mine used to work at EY.
The bench.
Yeah.
I was never given that.
Those that are out of gainful employment
are
benched, and they're supposed to go and do training courses, you name it, but
it's a mini
sabbatical.
All right.
Until they find project work. So that could be a place to look. But you're right, it's about kind of efficiency of staff usage.
So there's a huge amount of egos at Joker 5, as there are in any creative agency. That's fair enough. Like, it's the way it's how these companies are grown. But they will then come in as middle management, I believe, as part of the Accenture family.
I mean, that's a very, very interesting semantic debate.
Yeah.
So the coveted title in Accenture is managing director. There are hundreds of them, but that is seen as the kind of job to get. That's what they will be jostling for. They'll be jostling for those positions. Amongst my mates, if I can call the people who you know I'm referring to my mates, we were quietly kind of going, well, you know, does my future really lie here? Or does my future lie in the bigger, braver Accenture world? And so should I be cozying up to the really important people in Accenture and thinking about a career going forward? Well, I don't think I ever said that, but clearly that was said to me and it went through my mind. And I was lucky because I got benched, probably.
And how was it?
So it meant that I worked with Accenture quite closely for the last 6 months of my time, and you won't be surprised to hear me say the people I met were about 20 years younger than me, had several more degrees than I did, super bright. And the one thing I would say that I think we can learn from them is they have an amazing ability to swarm. So when a client opportunity arises, they will gather the very best from all over the world and they fly in. And they probably don't even know each other, but within 48 hours, they manage to create an incredibly efficient working team. They all swarm around the client problem, and their intellectual abilities that they all bring to it start to resolve it. And I think that's where the hierarchy is important, you know, because people do quickly fall into place a bit in a militaristic way.
Yeah, which doesn't happen very often within a creative agency.
I was
so
going to say,
that's going to be really interesting.
Pause there for a minute, and I'll confess a weakness. If I was confronted with a really tough pitch, I would surround myself with, well, obviously with you, which is what I mean by that, is people I have known for a long time that think like me, that I don't have to explain stuff really, really slowly and complicatedly. We just get it because we work together. And that's not what they don't do.
That just sparked something in my head, which is about the idea of trust. And the idea that these people who work for Accenture have a trust in something bigger than their sort of, you know, other people. It's about the company. It's about how the company works. So they trust the processes of the business, that they know they'll get the best people to work with them. So their egos become a secondary thing. And it's just about the most effective way of answering a problem. Whilst in a creative agency, it's very much like, I don't trust them, or I do trust them, or I prefer working with them, and I'd rather do that. So
I think that choice is taken out of it.
Exactly,
the friend I referenced there, one of his main tasks, as he's become more senior, his main task is often casting. Getting the right team together. So he'll go in first, for example, and then it's all about casting, getting the right people in. But there isn't like... he doesn't really have that choice of like, no, not that person, that person. It's about level, skill set, get them in.
I think we may have touched on this earlier. The opportunity in terms of business development is huge. I've forgotten what the stats are, but Accenture works with 90% of the Fortune 500. It's something like that. I'm sorry, I'm no longer on their payroll, so I can't remember what the messages are. But that comes with its challenges. And I think, you know, if I can be arrogant enough to say, if anybody from Droga5 is listening, here's two things I would watch out for. One is the obvious one, which is the process. And there are some people inside your organization who are going to be swamped with Accenture-like stuff. The way that, down to the simple way you get a pay rise for your direct reports, that is no longer going to be a simple, I think he deserves a pay rise. There'll probably be three layers of bureaucracy that you now need to going to have to fight through to get the pay rise and make sure it's all kind of done on the right way and all this kind of stuff. But a whole world of bureaucracy and reporting, because like it or not, that used to be an accounting firm and that's how they work and they've run the same way ever since. So welcome to bureaucracy. Droga5 colleagues. I think the other one is that opportunity, and I would describe it as a fire hose, because they will be the shiny new toy for those thousands and thousands of Accenture consultants who are wandering around. And no offense, ladies and gentlemen, Accenture consultants, you are salespeople, because they know they are only as good as their last consulting gig. So they're always trying to look for a new project that they can sell so that they remain gainfully employed and they move up their quite clearly bureaucratic performance ladders. And they will be selling Droga5 all the time, and the phone will be ringing at Droga5 with opportunities that will be eye-wateringly exciting. But the reality, how many of those are real opportunities? How many of those are real opportunities before they chase, you know, think of a mega brand that they could pitch to, but really there's no creative opportunity there. Mm-hmm. So I think they are the two things, bureaucracy and beware the fire hose. One brand that I think has been consistently brave, and Ben, one of your favourite campaigns is one of their anti-police campaigns, really. I'm talking about Lush, who also, it must be the best smelling brand on the high street. Am I the only person who can smell a Lush from 100 yards away?
You certainly know when you've walked past one.
Smell a Lush from 100 yards away. It means many things.
But there was a story recently about them abandoning social media, which I'm going to give my cynical point of view straight away, and then Paul, please jump in, which is, yes, I mean, let's jump on that bandwagon because the social media, the big bad social media boys are making our lives a misery. So I'm walking away from all that.
I think they're trying to avoid the negativity that comes with the comments. It's an interesting one because they've had a lot of success in social media. A lot of their campaigns have worked really well. They cut their teeth doing social media marketing. They've got good followings, like over 500,000 on one of their channels. Another quote was like over 10 million views on some of their videos. So they've got like significant statistics. From their press release, it's harder and harder to talk to each other directly. We're tired of fighting algorithms, which felt very strange.
Well, like, that means that they weren't getting the stuff they wanted to the top of news feed.
Then within a matter of lines, they're talking about kind of customer services, which is very different.
Now it's making a bit more sense. Were they alluding to the continued echo chamber type conversations that social media tends to promote? Is that what you think they meant?
I don't think so. No, I think they don't go into sort of comments and conversations. They just kind of quite neatly go into saying we want to have more direct conversations with you, so come and do it on our own,
on a one to one basis.
Yeah, exactly. So they're kind of trying to direct them to kind of either a customer services page or phone number. I don't know the answer to this. Do they have any controversy in the production of their products?
No, not the controversy. They've got some... So they ran a campaign last year, which was a campaign against undercover police who were sent into environmental activist groups to have affairs with environmental activists in order to get information about them.
Really?
So Lush support the activists, so therefore have then done this anti sort of like undercover police campaign. I'm massively oversimplifying it. I agree with Mark. I think like part of this is they understand that actually social media has become a tax for most brands as opposed to an opportunity to really communicate properly with people. And you can see all the sort of the comments, all the negative comments industry comments are coming from people who work in the social media industry.
Who
obviously.
Are worried about losing advertising.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's pretty. I mean, so
it's like this Facebook Zero, wasn't it? Which is a big thing when we were at Edelman, which is like there is no more organic reach.
They're naturally quite a social brand. What they do, their products, it's very visual. And so they'll all be still be, you know, doing stuff which people want to share on social.
I think the main reason they've done it is simply because you can't smell Facebook.
There's a fragrance that's here today and they call it Charlie. A different fragrance that thinks your way and yeah, they call it Charlie. Kinda young, kinda now, Charlie. Kinda free, kinda wow, Charlie. Kinda fragrance that's gonna stay and it's here now.
Charlie by Revlon, a most original fragrance.
So moving to the exciting world of e-commerce, and there have been a couple of stories about ASOS. One was about they're still struggling financially, and possibly linked to that is a move which I know has been hyped up a bit, and I'm exaggerating it when I say, Ben, they're going to stop us sending stuff back.
Well,
do you send stuff back?
No, I've never got into that. Like, I know that it's a sort of, it's now become sort of a standard part of buying online.
I cannot be bothered.
No, I don't. Yeah. I mean, I'd rather.
It's too much hassle.
It also just, this almost like it's a sort of a more carefree decision process of, I'll just get those three things, see what works, and send the other stuff back. I think this is linked, obviously, to they issued a profit warning before Christmas, and they're sort of. Interim pre-tax profits are just rocket going straight
spiraling down,
spiraling completely out of control. They've gone from 1.2 billion of sales a year ago to just 3.2 million. They're saying a third of all products are returned. Is that right?
Paul and I were just discussing this. So we were doing a bit of fact checking, which, as you know, is unusual for us.
But only yeah, exactly. This is an anomaly for this podcast.
But only
there's
because
some actual facts.
Paul and I were genuinely interested in it because he knows I'm a bit of a shopping geek.
It's part of this culture of like.
It's a throwaway culture.
And not owning stuff as well. There's coming into that, which is the reason I found this really interesting, is because it coincides with some huge campaigns for a brand called Klarna. Klarna is a payment system, which I believe is working with ASOS as one of their sort of partners. And what Klarna allows you to do is to buy and then to not pay for anything until you've returned it, until you've actually decided you're going to keep it. I can go on ASOS, I can buy 10 things, I can wear them for a month, I can return them all. And that's me,
and that's
fine.
What they're trying to stop, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And it's a difficult thing because they've obviously set that sort of that standard, that precedent for with their sort of their customers a long time ago. That kind of freedom, that fluid payment, that fluid ownership, that fluid sort of, you know, process of sort of returning clothes.
Yeah.
To suddenly turn the tap off on that is going to be difficult.
They've all created this, haven't they? And they're sort of the growing competition of the Boohoos and all those sort of people. They've been adding different offers and for returning, make it much more appealing, making it much more easier.
And I don't think people realise that the shelf life of a fashion product is, you told me, 45 days, did you say?
Something, yeah.
So once it's manufactured and it goes into the inventory management system, if it is not resident on a human being within 45 days, it is dead.
Mm.
It has no commercial value whatsoever. So I might have got some of those numbers wrong.
I think it goes into like a discounted phase.
There is a definite shelf life to these products. And so one of the tools that we talked about with our clients was, first of all, incentivizing returns behavior quicker. So I know that's a whole, it seems to be making the problem worse. But one of the problems is that these products, they go out and they just sit in our wardrobe. Well, not even in our wardrobe.
And then
they sit in a box.
Okay. Yeah.
And we don't open them, or we open them and we don't do anything with them. And then if that product is still returned within the legal, according to that particular retailer's terms and conditions, if it's then returned within their legal time, I get my money back, but they end up with a product that they can't do anything with. And worst case scenario, it ends up at landfill recycling.
And even if they can do something with it, they'll probably be selling it at half price.
Yeah, massively.
They just return 30 quid, can only sell it for 15, maybe can't sell it.
Yeah.
Multiply that by a nation.
There's one area that we haven't touched on, which is how much of this is verging on compulsive behaviour.
Addicted shoppers.
Yeah.
Well, that's when I first saw the headline, I was like, I immediately thought, again, with my gambling background, I thought self-exclusion. They're offering people the chance to self-exclude, which is very, very common in gambling, which is they very commonly offer people, do you need to self-exclude for some period? That's what I first thought when I saw this, which is, oh, okay, that makes sense. People are going crazy buying like several items a day. We should offer them, like, socially, we should offer them protection by managing them with an opportunity to self-exclude.
Well, I was lucky enough to be at the recent Marketing Society evening event when Gemma Greaves interviewed Peter Duffy, who's had an amazing marketing career and is now the interim CEO of Just Eat. And it was almost at the end of the evening that Hugh Burkitt asked a question from the audience that was almost certainly on everyone else's mind, and I've paraphrased it a bit, but it was something like, so you've got the top job, Peter, why don't you want to keep it? And Peter's slightly guarded response, I think, sums up the impression he left us all with. Peter's a smart and decent scouser, an inspiring customer-centric marketer that we'd all want to work for, I think. Well, he said his reasons for only agreeing to the CEO role as an interim thing were private, but he gave some strong hints when he said that for him, the CEO job had four important aspects to it. The board, the share price, the people, and his family. And the one area that he couldn't give on was his family. He also added that he loved his customer job and he didn't want to get too disconnected from it. Well, you can read more about what Peter said on the Marketing Society website. And there's more opportunities to hear from some fascinating industry leaders coming up. There's former Unilever CEO Paul Polman, and he'll be speaking on the evening of the 13th of May. And ITV's CEO Carolyn McCall joins us on the morning of the 25th of June. And you can make a booking for both of those events by emailing bookings@marketingsociety.com. That's bookings@marketingsociety.com.
Malaria isn't just any disease. It's the deadliest disease there's ever been.
So let's take a look at some recent campaigns, and this edition they're all filmic, and the first one features David Beckham, and it's a campaign to raise money to get rid of malaria. It's quite cleverly called Malaria Must Die, I think. Is that right?
That's the one.
Yeah, okay.
It's a really interesting sort of piece of work. It's very simple. It's just David Beckham talking, but what's really clever about it, obviously he's using his fame, but apart from that, they're using these things, it's called deep fake technology, which is a type of AI powered video synthesis technology, which allows you to sort of to put people's voices onto another face, and it's quite controversial because it was quite linked to the potential for creating fake news. If you could imagine how this could be used for that kind of purpose as well, but it's being used by
I can literally put my words in your mouth.
Other people's mouths.
Yeah,
there we
exactly.
go.
I didn't even think about that.
I should have got to that faster.
That's scary.
Yeah, it's been a slow morning. Anyway, so yeah, it's a really and also what's interesting is it's almost like a DRTV ad essentially, because it's about asking people to sign a petition with their voice. So it's the first voiced petition of its kind, and it's demanding like this urgent political response to malaria as a global fund meeting in October.
I can see the creative brief now and obviously I didn't do this, but if I'd written the positioning, a very lame proposition, which was to add your voice to this campaign, and some smart creative person went, aha.
Yeah, exactly.
What if I actually did that?
There you go. So it's David Beckham talking in his own voice, and then loads of different voices and loads of different languages are then sort of like put onto his face.
Se dice que ha matado más de la mitad de la población que ha existido.
And I'm so pleased because his voice drives me crazy.
It's getting better with age.
Oh, it isn't.
It is.
It isn't.
There is one of the voices he does which sounds similar to his.
Oh, it's just awful.
Yeah, which is sort of like, you know, from Kazakhstani or something like that.
I can't believe the amount of media training and good knows what else and image that he's had, and his voice just still makes me... It's a bit like nails down a blackboard.
I can't get over the movement of his eyebrows as he talks.
Oh, I noticed that.
Have a watch.
Okay, we'll be looking out for the eyebrows.
I think, obviously it's got a celebrity in it, but the virality of it will be would be very, very impressive, I imagine.
Because it's clever.
This deep fake technology, you're kind of like, you're looking at his lips going, oh, has he rehearsed that? Has he learned it? And then it's... So I think the virality will be a very good thing for this.
Malaria must die so millions can live.
And the next ad that we're going to talk about is a celebration of 150 years of Heinz. And I was standing behind Paul as he was watching it for the first time, and you said, that's making me hungry. Which must be a great result for any creative to kind of go, wow.
It did. I mean, I had had an early lunch. It was about 6 o'clock. So I probably could have watched anything. I would have said I was hungry. But hey, yeah, it was. So this is Heinz at 150 years old. Brands are obviously always looking for a milestone to celebrate. 150 is pretty, pretty impressive. So well done them. And the ads, yeah, it's done by PBH. It is what I would call proper TV when I first saw it. You know, it's soundtrack, the sort of thing you could be dual screening and you suddenly look, because it's got a great, great soundtrack, highly visual, basically a real fast cut of vignettes going through different food environments. Quite unsurprisingly, over the last 150 years, the use of Heinz, mainly ketchup. And yeah, just a real fun, high-paced advert, and really well done, I think.
But it's the line, isn't it? It's the celebrating clean plates for 150 years, which yes, I love. Yeah, I think that's a really sort of like lovely way of summing it up.
That is a great proposition, that your meal will have that extra special thing with a bit of Heinz on it.
It is, and we talked about a few weeks ago to me about kind of why that these products still are successful with a price premium against all their competition. It's like, because they feel like they're part of the family home, and this is just absolutely nailing that.
I like it. Finally, I'm going to put two ads together, if I may, Ben. I know you wanted to talk about these, because both Foster's and M&S have reached into their video archives to pull out old ideas. And it just kind of go, really? Have we run out of new ideas? Do Foster's and M&S need to dig out campaigns that I think they're both over 10 years old and reinvigorate them, because they've got nothing left in their creative cabinet?
I think it's really clever, because I think what they're both are slightly different versions of. They're really strong creative vehicles, and like sort of Foster's is a format which is sort of got the two characters, a style, a language.
I can't do the Aussie accent. You both can, because you've been there.
Very clever little update on that sort of format of sort of people calling in and sort of asking these two Aussie dudes for advice on sort of quite sort of very British social situations. You know, the idea of it being a good call, it's all very good. But this one's about sort of about craft beer, and sort of makes it, just brings it up to contemporary sort of discussions and contemporary sort of trends around that industry. So I just thought it was really simple. Why not do it? And it's actually sort of probably will do really well.
Foster's, good call.
The M&S one's slightly different, in the sense that it's a slight change. It's taking the same, it's almost taking the piss out of itself a little bit, and bringing back this idea of, you know, it's not just food. It's M&S food, and it's done in these really funny sort of comedic scenarios where people are sort of almost aping the original ad by creating their own version of that sort of like almost sort of food porn voice.
The next train on platform one is succulent M&S Scottish salmon, perfectly pan-seared.
Ultra HD TV with trifle. The best ever from M&S. Fruity compote and tons of vanilla custard.
In our bubble, either the same week or something, there was the announcement that they were going to be the main sponsor of Britain's Got Talent. And I'm sorry, this is probably my age, and I would never have put Marks and Spencer's in the same demographic bag as Britain's Got Talent viewers. I really wouldn't. And it smacked of desperation. So to hear that they were going back to an old ad style, and they were going into a massive populist place that I would never have put them, I just thought, wow, are you really struggling? Are you really directionless now? And are they running those food porn ads in Britain's Got Talent?
They must have done the math, though, surely, that the ITV audience must be, or the Britain's Got Talent audience must be broad enough
Of course it is.
To have significant reach for M&S.
That's
a big investment, isn't it?
It will still be cost per thousand effective, cost-effective, to go with a massive TV vehicle like Britain's Got Talent, rather than trying to be smart and only advertising in the Sunday Times or something like that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. But my argument is more to do with the halo effect that Britain's Got Talent would have on Marks and Spencer's. That's my point. I just don't put those two brands together.
Well, they are a struggling business. They have been for a long time, haven't they? So maybe that they are having to broaden their appeal. And the way to do it is to take what was effectively quite a sort of like high-end food, sort of, I said, food porn production from when it was first created into something which is a bit more funny and a bit more accessible, is them going, well, okay, well, yeah, come on, we're the same, you know, you can come to us as well as Tesco's and Lidl. Like, do you know what I mean? I think there's a sort of, let's take something which was really entertaining, let's make it funny, and then let's make it more accessible.
Okay, I can see a strategy now.
Well, what they've done really cleverly is taking a successful creative vehicle and then just made it a bit funnier and more accessible and easy for people to sort of really relate to. And I think it could be really smart.
Hey, abuela, this is not just food. This is M&S food. Dig in.
Well, sadly, that's all we've got time for this episode from our new studio-like offices. Welcome to our new home.
Welcome, yes.
Are you enjoying New Oxford Street?
I think it's okay.
The office is directly opposite a Pret. Is that okay for you?
It gets thumbs up from me. I think it's a much quieter, more professional environment to create a
professional
podcast.
Oh dear, we've got to stop that.
I know.
I hope the audio's been better. We've certainly been more relaxed. So there you go.
Well, I've enjoyed it. See you next time.
See you guys.
See you later.
Bye.